where you live shouldn't limit your access to quality internet. That's not fair. U.S. Cellular introduces fast and fair high-speed internet. With reliable home internet from U.S. Cellular, now there's no limit to how you stream, game, and work. So instead of this, you get this. Upgrade to fast and fair high-speed internet from U.S. Cellular. Upgrade to fair.
If you are somebody who continually comes across the same obstacles in life, maybe you'd like some timeless life secrets to get you through. If that's the case, today's guest is going to be exactly who you need to listen to. Welcome to the Awakening You podcast, reminding you that the answers are within. My name is Scott Goyette, and I'm your host. Each week in this podcast, I will be sharing some simple yet very useful tools to help you dive deep and discover how infinitely powerful you really are. The show is based on specific growth models created by the Go Love Now movement that will help you choose love and move through your fears. The Love Model, L-O-V-E, stands for listening, observing, voicing, and empathizing. The Fear Model, F-E-A-R, stands for forgiving, eliminating beliefs that no longer serve you and may have never served you, accepting yourself and others where you or they are at in their journey, and rising up and becoming resilient. During each podcast, my amazing guests will share their experience with using these tools and how you might benefit from using them as well. All information shared during this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. Nothing from this podcast should supersede the directions of a doctor or mental health professional. And today's guest is a very new friend of mine, but nonetheless, an amazing human being who we're getting to know and just falling in love with everything the other one has to say. She actually is the daughter of the co-founder of the Sheraton Hotel chain. She's also the widow of Frank Perdue, who ran the Perdue Chicken Empire. Here's my special friend, Mitzi Perdue.
What an absolute total joy to be with you.
Thank you so much for being here. We've had some great conversations that we've had off air, and there's some of the stuff you have not shared with me, and you said we're going to save it for this interview. So I'm very excited. First and foremost, tell the audience a little bit more about you, more than what I've said, because you're an amazing human being, and they need to get to know you a little bit better.
Gosh, I'm not sure how I can live up to the amazing human being part, but I will tell you a little bit about myself. I am the daughter of the co-founder and president of the Sheraton Hotel chain. My late father started the company in the 1930s. He built it from no employees to 20,000 at the time of his death. And by the way, we did sell the chain, but he did build it from nothing to 20,000, and he owned 400 hotels at the time of his death. And he used to say, the entire secret of his success was the people who worked with him. And eventually, I would love to share some of his secrets for how he got people to be eager to go the extra mile for him, to stay with him for life, to just give their all to building something huge and wonderful. My late husband, Frank Perdue, accomplished something remarkably similar to what my father did. He took a chicken company. It was one of 5,000 chicken companies on the eastern shore of Maryland to one that became the third largest in the whole world. I think it's the whole world, certainly the third largest in the United States. And he also managed to do pretty much the same thing that my father did in the same way. And it all has to do with a loving, giving, caring, generous attitude towards the people who worked with him. And as for myself, I founded a company, it's called Ceres Farms. If you're a wine drinker and you've had California wines such as Robert Mondavi, Kendall Jackson, Joel Gott, there are dozens of them. You might have tasted wine from grapes from my vineyard. So I'm into business myself. And generally, the people that I've worked with have stayed with me for life. My administrative assistant, we're into our third decade.
That is awesome. That is amazing. And I love hearing the idea of human capital and really supporting people. And that's the driving force behind the business. One of the things that I talk about quite a bit in Go Love Now and sharing the love and the fear model is helping people find their brilliance. Because when people find their brilliance, what happens? They end up very loyal to you because they're loyal to themselves, and the collective grows. Because the minute I find my brilliance, the value comes from the connection to others and bringing it to the table. So it sounds like your dad and your late husband both did the exact same thing. Tell me more about that.
Okay, I'm going to say exactly the same thing. And it's just amazing how it all kind of seems to come down to some of the same, what I call timeless secrets of success. But for my father, when he was buying a hotel, and as I said, he had 400 at the time of his passing, he started out in the 1930s, the early 1930s, at the height of the Great Depression. It was at a time when there was 25% unemployment in this country, the United States. That was a time when everybody was rushing away from real estate or from hotels, particularly hotels. In fact, it reminds me of today, everybody's rushing away from airlines because it just seemed like a one-way ticket to bankruptcy to invest in a hotel. Well, how was father able to turn hotels around and make them an incredible success and start with one hotel and have them reach 400 by the time of his death? And I, as a little girl growing up, I was forever asking him, now, Daddy, how did you do it? And he'd share stories. And one that I just treasure, he told me whenever he'd take over a hotel, and if we're talking the Great Depression, he knew the people that he had just inherited when he had taken possession of the hotel, he knew probably every one of them was just as scared as could be that they're going to lose their job with the new owner. You know, it would just be typical back at that time and probably even today. If you're the new owner, you bring in the people that you know and trust. You probably take care of your relatives and your best friends. So when he took over a hotel, he was perfectly aware that everybody there was worried about keeping his or her job. So the day he took possession, he'd invite everybody in the hotel, and there could be 400 or 800 employees because hotels have a lot of employees that you don't see. He'd invite all of them to come into the ballroom of the hotel, and the first words out of his mouth was, I want every one of you to keep your job. And the reason I want every one of you to stay here is because I know that you know your job better than anybody else in the city. Wow. Nobody knows what you know, and I don't want to train somebody new. No, my job in all of this is to give you the support and the resources to show the world just how good you are. Because you'll see, in a few months, this hotel is going to be the most popular hotel in the whole city. It's going to be the best served, the most financially stable. It's going to be an example to every other business in this city that things can turn around and that they can get better. You know, those are very encouraging words, but that's just the beginning of the story. There's a part two. And the part two was amazing. Probably, I'm going to guess, more important than the part one. And the part two is the next day, you know, the employees had heard all these nice words and they, you know, the pain and fear that they had of being afraid of losing their jobs, that's gone. But, you know, how much could you trust that he really meant all this? Well, he'd demonstrate it. And he told me that every hotel he ever took over or built, he'd do the same thing. If you were an employee at that hotel, the day after this talk that he had given, you'd see cavalcades of people coming in like decorators, electricians, plumbers. They were refurbishing the hotel because if a hotel's gone bankrupt, you know, it's gone to seed. You have to freshen it up. But Father told me that he never spent any money on the public rooms, the places that the paying public would see, until he had totally refurbished the employee areas. So if you weren't there, you wouldn't see these decorators and people who are spiffing up the place go to the public rooms. No, they're going to your lockers, showers, dining rooms, employee lounges. So I, as a little girl, would ask him, why wouldn't you at least be tempted to put money where you'd get it back immediately because the paying public would see that this place is coming back to life? And he said, because if you really want a success, it's the people at every level who make it a success. And by putting the money there first, it's communicating to them. It's showing to them, it's demonstrating in ways that they can see and feel and touch that they're important and that we're counting on you and that they're part of this team. How about the most important part of the team? So he would communicate to them their importance by spending the first refurbishing money on the areas that only they would see. Is that cool?
That is absolutely amazing. And it's very interesting because one of the things that I teach as far as the Go Love Now program is I teach customer service. And guess how I teach it? I tell them that customer service, by their definition, is a symptomatic illusion. So they're thinking that they have to go out and make sure that the communication with the customers is enhanced. And I tell them, take care of your internal customers and your employees, and a byproduct of a healthy culture is effective customer service. And I'll lose a certain amount of potential clients saying that, but the ones I get, I know truly get it, and I know they're going to reap the benefits. So I go.
Well, look where it took my father. To my mind, it's a timeless secret of success. But my story actually has four parts, and we've gone through two parts. Okay, part number three. I'm a little girl, and I'm extremely aware that my father is unbelievably successful because, you know, we have a very large house and we stay, you know, at Presidential Suites. It's just, you know, really clear to me that Daddy has made it. And so, you know, I'm asking him all these questions about how he did it. So he'd already told me about how he would spend the first money on the employees. But I'd ask him questions like, why didn't you tell people, yeah, you can keep your job if you do a good job? Yeah, why do you just give sort of a blanket or a blank check? You keep your job, I'm here to support you. Why did you take that position? And he had an answer. I told you there were four parts to this story. This is part three, and part three has three subparts. Can we handle all of that?
I love it.
Yeah, we can. I'll help you.
I want more info.
Okay, part number one. He said that you can get people to do what you want in three major ways. I mean, there may be 100 ways, but in his world, there were three categories of ways of getting to people to do what you want. And he said, number one is intimidation. He said he could have stood up there at that ballroom and he could have said, shape up or you're fired. You know, let them be scared. That's intimidation. He said, that's always a bad strategy because you can get compliance, but it's grudging. They'll do the absolute minimum because they're resentful. They're not buying into your vision. Intimidation is a rotten way to get compliance. I mean, you'll get some, but it's a rotten way. Part two is gentler and kinder, but still in his world, no good. And that is bribery. He said, I could have stood up there and said, hey, if you all do an outstanding job, there's a raise in it for you, or there's a bonus in it for you. But he said, that's also an ineffective way of getting compliance. I mean, you can get it, but it's too transactional. People are working with, you know, the monetary bribe in mind. He said, there are two problems. They're not working for something huge. They're working for something small and transactional. And he said, you have to keep raising the ante because after you've bribed for a while, I'm using my words, not his, but the typical reaction is after a while, what have you done for me lately? You have to keep raising the ante. So he's against intimidation. He was against bribery. So in Ernest Henderson's world, what was the third way, the one that he endorsed and recommended to everybody, and I recommend it to everybody? It was inspire, don't require. He said, people have a compulsion to live up to or down to your expectations. And he said, a leader's job is to give people a better vision of themselves. And when he would communicate with them, they're part of a team that's going to make this the best hotel in the city. What he's communicating is, you're a waitress. Your job isn't just about clearing dishes or bringing in food. You're a chambermaid making the beds, or you're a bartender tending bar. No, that's not what you're really doing. What you're really doing is building an enterprise that's going to be an example, a shining example to the whole rest of the city, that things can turn around and get better. So inspire, don't require, was the kind of thing that would make people excited to come to work, make them want to give their all, want them even to be innovative and figure out how to do better. So he was 100% in favor of inspire, don't require, pretty much against bribery, and 100% against intimidation. That's part three.
Before we go to four, I just want to bring up something with that. You just nailed one of the things. I don't know if I told you, but I also am a business professor. And one of the things I push to my students, I talk about intrinsic and extrinsic rewards quite extensively. And I ask them what motivates them. And I would say out of 30 kids, 28 will pick an extrinsic reward. And two will say, I do things for a job well done. So the extrinsic rewards will be money, you know, time off, luxury, just a lot of things. And I say, if you had that today, what's different in your life? And they're like, I'm going to be happy and this and this. And I try to explain to them, that's not the way it works. And so then I let those two who are talking about intrinsic rewards of I do it because, and essentially what they're saying is they've been inspired by somebody to find their brilliance. And so what I'm hearing your dad did geniusly is he was helping them find their brilliance and lighting the light so they could look down and light their light. And so they came alive. Now imagine if everyone in the organization comes alive, what happens in that organization? You literally got to see your dad do what I'm teaching. You watched this happen. I can't say this enough. You and I and everybody who has this understanding needs to preach this like crazy, because this is literally how the world needs to work. We need to get people to light their fires, find their brilliance, contribute, and not be looking for these extraneous, you know, validations. It's got to come from inside. And the fact that you're sharing this on this show right now is one of the most beautiful things I've heard yet from anybody I've interviewed. So I wanted to thank you for that before we move to four, because I feel really inspired right now by this. Thank you.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that, because my purpose in life is to serve others. And if I can communicate anything useful to anyone, particularly you at this moment, yep. I'm happy. But yep. I mentioned that there's a part four, and the part four is, I think, the best of all. And that is, where did Father get his, I think, Olympic level genius of understanding human nature? Because his approach, I mean, I don't think he was following any contemporary role models. I've never heard of anybody else doing what he did. I mean, maybe there's somebody, but I believe I know how he got that understanding of human nature. I mean, aside from just being genuinely a good person to begin with, which he was, but he didn't start out with that genius understanding of human nature. In fact, there's a family story that I treasure. It's only recently that I've come to understand it in greater depth. The family story is, when my mother and father fell in love, my mother was from West Virginia, southern state. Father was from Cambridge, Massachusetts, northern state. Mother comes, east to meet her future in-laws. And she's in for an almighty shock, because Grandmother Berta, father's mother, greets my mother and tells her, don't marry Ernest. He can never stick to anything. He's not good at holding a job. He's just not a good marriage bet. If you marry him, you're going to end up poor. And imagine her, but mother's reaction was, I don't care. I love him. I believe in him. And they did marry. But what must have it have been for my father to hear his own mother telling the love of his life, don't marry her? All right, how about that was a wake-up call on just a cataclysmically huge level? And so Father, he told me this. He went to whatever the equivalent of the Yellow Pages was back in 1923, and he found a career guidance counselor, somebody who later became really famous, Johnson O'Connor. And I'm telling a story which, in a way, isn't favorable to the Johnson O'Connor Career Guidance Company. Well, we'll get into that, but here's the story. Yeah, we have to reframe what I'm about to tell, because I think it was fabulous that he went to them. Hmm. So he met Johnson O'Connor himself, and Johnson O'Connor spent pretty much a whole day putting him through all these different tests that would reveal what a career guidance counselor would then recommend to a client. And at the end of the day, Johnson O'Connor told my father, you have the worst human relations skills or understanding of other people that I've ever come across in my career. You're clearly a very bright young man. I think you could be a good scientist. The requirement for you having success in a career and sticking to something is you've got to somehow be in a laboratory where you can do experiments and use all your, you know, all those smarts that you clearly have, but that you don't have to interact with people. Well, Father took this as a challenge. And by the way, back to Johnson O'Connor, because I don't want to malign him. He was clearly right. And when I said that I've come to understand this story more as I get older, look at grandmother telling her future daughter-in-law, don't marry Ernest. I mean, that's not what we would call today high emotional intelligence. I'm thinking that father got it from his parents.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, he was diagnosed by an eminently reputable, respectable person as having the worst human relations skills of anybody that he had ever come across. And father took this as a challenge. Because he came to the conclusion, sort of looking around at the world, and I endorse this, and I bet anything that you and our listeners would endorse also, and that is that success in life depends extraordinarily on your ability to get along with people. And father's thinking, you know, if I want to be able to stick to a job, if I want to do anything in life, I've got to crack the code that I'm not innately good at of getting along with people. And he began a lifelong quest of learning whatever he could about what makes people tick. And I know, for example, that he took the Dale Carnegie course of How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yep.
He told me, and my mother told me, that each of them would read that book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, every 10 years, because they thought that was one of the magic keys. But in father's case, he'd attend lectures, he'd read books, he'd take courses, he'd take like salesmanship courses, public speaking courses, anything that he could to better and better and better understand human nature. And later on in life, he'd even make friends with very famous psychologists and psychiatrists, and they'd be guests of ours at our country home for the weekend. You know, names that if you're in the field, B.F. Skinner is a really huge name, or Eddie Bernays, you know, people, famous names. You know, as he got farther along in his career, he could make friends with these people. And the unending quest was to have an ever better understanding of what motivates people. And that meant that when he got into the hotel industry, he probably knew more about human nature and human motivation than any of his competitors. For example, he knew that when he stood up in front of his employees that first day, that they probably wouldn't listen to a word he said, because they'd be so preoccupied with, I'm going to lose my job, my life is almost over. Yeah, when he could take away that pain point by the first words out of his mouth telling everybody that they're keeping their job, then they're ready to listen to the rest. And I think, I mean, this is kind of a guess, but I could guess that the reason Sheraton grew so fast, so successfully, you know, people who started with father generally stayed with him for life and loved him. But I think it's because his greatest deficit became his greatest asset. He worked so hard on empathy and understanding that he transcended his weakness to make it his greatest strength. And I do believe that that's the reason for Sheraton's success, because he got it.
That is absolutely amazing and so in line. One of the things I actually have not shared with you is the love model. And I want to share this with you right now. And you're going to see the amazing synergy to what your dad believed and was teaching. And I want to actually say one other thing for our listeners. I hear so many people who are students or older folks, anybody, we have this illusion that because we're not good at something, then we shouldn't pursue it. And we have this belief that, hey, I'm not good at this. And we hear about the term growth mindset. Start embracing that with everything. Just because you're not good at something today does not mean you can't be amazing at it. So you're just not good yet. And start plugging that into everything you think. And I want to come back to sharing the love model with you. So the love model is listen, observe, voice, and empathize. And so it's an acronym for love. And it's listening to your intuitive self. We teach how to more deeply connect to source, God, universe, whatever you believe to be, you know, the eternal superconscious, like all knowing. And then in turn, once we connect to that, what happens is, you know, people like you and I, like, why did you and I meet? We met because there's something we're supposed to be doing here. So we're angels to one another. And so what happens is once you start listening to your intuitive self, the angels show up to help you continue to grow that mission. Your dad's angels literally were his employees and vice versa. It's a two-way street. We always think it's a one-way street, an angel. Absolutely not. He was an angel for them. And then he empowered them with their brilliance. And in turn, he benefited as well. And it still comes downhill to you. And now all the things you're doing for the world came from his listening. It literally stemmed from that. The observe piece is observing your needs. So it's first and foremost, being an active observer of what you need. So your dad listened to your mom and said, wait a second, if this is the case and I can't be a good husband, I'm going to go figure out what it's going to take for me to be somebody who can be effective in a job so I can be a good husband. He was constantly observing what he needed to grow. Now think of what happens. Now you're an active observer internally. Now you can be an active observer externally, which your dad did 100%, because he looked when he walked in and he knew those people were literally at the base of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They're in a place of fear. So they're saying, am I emotionally safe? Am I physically safe? And he instantly elevated him to a place of, you're here in your family. So now they're in social and esteem. He gave instant elevation because he was an active observer who took action to assist. And that was beautiful. And then the next piece is the voice. The voice of your mom saying, I don't know if you're going to be a good husband. He's listening to that. Instead of saying it, that you're not a good husband, it was a challenge. He spun that voice and said, you are a good husband because you've taken the actions you needed to do. So he actually turns that into a positive voice. That positive voice now can spin out to his employees and to his children. So he can say, I know you can, and here's why I know. And so he's literally lifting you up. And then the final piece, which we know he had and you have and I have tenfold, empathy. We've got to empathize with all. We're going to make mistakes. Sometimes we're going to be human and make errors. But if we listen, observe, voice, and empathize, we're clearing the lenses. And so we're clearing the distortions so we can connect more deeply to truth and impact this world positively. And I want you to look at it. It's listen, observe, voice, and empathize. So it's my ears, my eyes, my mouth, and my heart. Those are the senses that we're most deeply connecting to this world with. So all we're doing is we're cleaning those off and removing the distortions so we have the ability to be the best us we can and find the brilliance which your dad was able to find in others. So I'm listening to you and I'm almost like, can we move on to the next world and hang out with your dad? Because I want to share this with him. I want to learn from him. So...
Well, I'm thrilled to see my father's life through that lens of listen, observe, voice, empathize. But then I think, you know, it applies to my late husband as well. Yes. But I first want to emphasize that when my father passed, we did sell the hotel corporation. So I don't want people to assume that I'm still connected with it. I mean, sure. I still wish Sheraton well, but we did sell it. But my late husband, I think he was also the embodiment of listen, observe, voice, empathize. I'm a writer by trade. So One of the things that it's in my training, it's in my personality is to take notes on stuff. I mean, I just do. And one of the things that I noticed about Frank, absolutely genius level person, but in his interactions with people, whether it's like at a cocktail party or maybe a cab driver and he's in the car or a board of directors or a sales meeting, Frank regularly would listen 90% of the time and talk 10% of the time. You know, I admire that. I try to copy it and I fail right and left, but it's something I aspire to because it's so obviously the right approach. And one of the ways he sort of explained this is none of us is as smart as all of us. So it's not up to him to generate all the brilliance. It's up to him to listen. Then for observing, I think he spent his whole life, sort of like my father did, kind of figuring out what works, what doesn't work, how do you get from here to there, observing what worked with people. Listen, observe.
Voice.
Voice.
That inner voice and the outer voice.
Okay, so Frank was different from most people that I can imagine because I'm unaware of him having any voice, internal voice, that would undermine him. As far as I can tell, he wasn't held back by doubts. And I can think of, how about like on an almost weekly basis for 17 years, where I'd see him doing things that I'd think, you know, my little voice is thinking, that can't be done. He can't pull that off. No, that's impossible. But if you're not held back by little voices telling you you can't do it, he would just plunge ahead and make things happen. I think he was very much a realist. And I wouldn't say that he was super optimistic. He was just, I'm going to make this happen. And he was genius at doing it. I'll give you a couple of examples. He was the first person, at least in this country, and I'm going to assume the world, to advertise a commodity. Before the 1960s, you would advertise like brands, but you wouldn't advertise something like chicken. We're going back to the 1960s now. Back then, it was the assumed wisdom that you would never advertise a commodity like chicken or grain or whatever. You wouldn't advertise it because it would be pouring money down a rat hole. You might get people to buy more chicken, but you're benefiting all your competitors and not yourself. So that just the universal wisdom was, don't ever advertise a commodity. But Frank's business model was, I'm going to produce the best chicken that there is. And that means, you know, cleaner water, better feed, nicer living conditions, healthier birds, plumper breasts, you know, 100 things, but all of which costs a lot of money. And if you don't advertise why your birds are better, people wouldn't understand why you're charging a premium for it. Because, I mean, you're going to go bankrupt if you charge the same price and it costs you a whole lot more to make them. So the logic was that you should advertise. But Frank interviewed, I'm going to say, hundreds of people about advertising. And how about all of them said, don't do it. It's foolish. It's stupid. Frank had such belief in advertising, or at least communicating with the buying public what made his special, that he ignored them all and he ignored all his inner voices. And within a matter of years, we went from like being one of thousands of chicken companies to being the top three. I think that he did it by not being overwhelmed by the little nasty negative voices saying, don't do it, you're going to fail. No, he just believed in it and went and did it. And as for empathy, good Lord, Frank was empathetic. He had a deep understanding that people want to feel important. This is a quote from William James, the psychiatrist from the 1900s, and Frank endorsed, the deepest principle of human nature is the craving for appreciation. And so Frank was just empathetic enough to get that, but he was also empathetic enough to realize that people want appreciation in different ways. You know, one of the things that I noticed was when somebody had achieved something wonderful, you know, it's very typical in all organizations to have some sort of ceremony. Frank recognized that some people, you know, what they really want is a great big party with balloons, but other people might prefer something more quiet and more personalized. And so Frank put a lot of effort into calibrating the recognition to what would mean the most to a person. And I want to give a particular example of that. There was a man who was a packaging expert, and you know, his entire academic training and career training was improving packaging. And he spent an entire year redesigning the great big cardboard packages that you as a consumer never see. But when, say, 40 pounds of chicken are leaving the processing plant, they're in a great big cardboard box. Let's say it's going to New York. A truck will take it from Salisbury, Maryland, or wherever the plant is, from, let's say it's Salisbury, to New York, and there a distributor will move it to another smaller truck, and it will eventually end up in grocery stores throughout New York. It's all one big package, but the truckload of stuff gets divided up. Well, Owen Schwiers, the packaging expert, figured out a way of making a better package. It was slightly different dimensions. It was slightly more crush-proof. It had just, I know that he'd put his whole soul into creating the absolute best packaging that the industry had ever seen. Frank loved it. Everybody in Purdue's loved it. But we did try it, you know, kind of on a small scale to just make sure that everybody else loved it. And guess what? They didn't. It's not just that they didn't, but they actively disliked having something different. And it wasn't any fault of Owen Schwiers, but if you're really used to grabbing something this size and this dimension, how about it failed in the marketplace? Well, Frank, as an empathetic person, realized that this has to be a horrible blow to Owen Schwiers, to put your life into something that you just know is better. Oh, let me give you an example of why it had to be better and wasn't. You could pack more boxes in the truck, which meant that, you know, ecologically lower carbon footprint. There's a whole lot of reasons why you want the boxes optimized. Nevertheless, it failed. So what did Frank do as an empathetic person? He created an award. It was called the Great Failed Project Award, and he got the entire board of directors to engrave on a bronze plaque, which was, I'm going to guess it might have been 2 feet by 3 feet. I mean, it was a great big giant bronze plaque with maybe 8 signatures engraved on it and called the Great Failed Project Award. And Frank delivered it to Owen. And Owen said that was, he told me that he had felt just absolutely terrible that what he had put so much effort and love and caring into had failed. But he said when Frank delivered this thing to him unexpectedly and personally handed it to him, that it took the sting away from it. And that when he looks back in his life, you know, the kindness of that one gesture made his life better. But imagine the empathy that goes into that. Yeah, Frank could have said, oh, you didn't do a good job, bad on you. No, he gave him the Great Failed Project Award. And Owen tells me that he has it, I think he has it in his living room, and it's like mounted, so it's first thing people see. It's just, you know, a source of unending joy for something that could have been a source of unending misery.
That is beautiful. And so it's interesting because I feel like the longer we talk, the more we realize the commonalities of our belief systems and, you know, your late husband and your dad. One of the things that I share with my students a lot is something that I do in consulting when I work with small businesses. I tell every manager, I say, how do you motivate your employees? And they all come and they tell me about some amazing strategy and plan that they have in place currently with their company. They're like, we give out American Express gift cards. We give a day off. We give a party. And they have pre-planned things. And I said, how do you know they actually like that? And so I could be in a group of 1,000 people and I say, how many people do not like when you are thanked in public? And like clockwork, if it's 1,000 or if it's 100, little over 50% don't like it every single time.
Well, I'm going to focus back on, rather than say anything negative, let me focus back on Frank. Frank got that some people would love it and some people wouldn't.
So this is the craziest part. So when I teach this, I literally have people say, yeah, but it's already working. And they say, you know, I like what you're saying, but it's going to take too much time to ask and whatever. We've already got a system in place. That's not important. And this goes back to the, I'm serious. Like, this is what gets crazy. Like, they won't quite say it like that to me. I'll call back in a month and go, hey, did you implement that action item I gave you? Like, yeah, you know, we're going to do that. We've had some other things. And I literally can feel the dismissal. Because they were saying, well, what we've got is working, but we'll look at that, which is really just passing over to tell me what else you got. And so my suggestion is you put 20 things down that are extrinsic motivators. And so it might be time off. It might be, you know, extra pay. It might be an advancement. It might be thank you in private. It might be thank you in public. And let them rank them on a 1 to 20. And whenever they do something great, like Frank did, you support them with exactly what they asked for. So you cannot be wrong. It's so simple.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
But here's the crazy thing. Frank would have been like, perfect. I'm going to give this, you know, concept to all our managers. I can go in right now to 100 small businesses, and I would bet 90 will say that sounds great, but not do anything about it. And the ones who like the idea or are going to implement it, most likely are kind of doing it, but they just haven't put it to paper. So the point is, one of the problems that we have is I'm listening to you celebrate human capital. People are still looking at bottom line, and they're not realizing if we elevate people to their truest brilliance, the bottom line takes care of itself always. This is another thing I want to share with you and I want to get your feedback on. I always ask people, anytime I'm doing a motivational speech, one of the questions I get up, I say, how many people here are fighters? And a massive chunk raise their hand. It depends on the group. You know, it could be 90%, it could be 50, depending on the group. And I say, I'm a fighter. Let me tell you some of the things that I fought to get. And I tell them some of my story and I get somebody else to stand up. Tell me what you fought for. And I go, so how many people here believe the only reason you've gotten what you've gotten is because you're a fighter? And 100% of those people who are fighters raise their hand. And then I challenge them and I say, okay, so you're sure that's the truth. I go, what does being a fighter entail? And so some people start saying, I don't take no for an answer. And say they start to say a lot of things that feel very aggressive and maybe not positive. And so I asked them, I said, what would your life look like if you actually just elevated your brilliance and just stepped into the flow? You just jumped in the river and let yourself flow with elevated brilliance, knowing that you're a beautiful human being. How can you prove to me that your fighting got you further? And so we start to actually kind of rewind and say, what would it have looked like? And we say, how many people did you irritate as a kid? How many people did you upset? And honestly, are you truly happy being a fighter? And at this point, if you've got 1,000 people, some people have tears in their eyes. Some people are like, well, I didn't know better. And I'm like, I'm not calling you out. I'm doing this too. Can we wake up today, recognize our brilliance, start being motivated by the right things and stop fighting? And that's something that I feel like too many of us, And that's the, you know, to that point, that's that manager who's sitting here saying, I'm not going to do it this way. I'm not going to do it this way. They're the fighter. They won't receive the simplest things and get into the flow and help people find their brilliance, which your dad and Frank did, and you're doing it. This is my question to you. How do we make more people, and I don't want to say make, because I don't want to force, that's even fighting itself. How do we inspire more people to see things like this so we can find our true brilliance?
You know, it kind of gets back to my father saying, inspire, don't require. Mm. You know, hold up a better vision. But that means, all right, if I could wave a magic wand, I think I'd have you leave Joe Rogan in the dust. I think somebody told me he has 12 million followers. I want you to have 50 million followers.
Yeah, and he's cool. I mean, I get it. He's just got a $200 million contract, so he's doing something right. But again, his $200 million contract, I forget with what network or whatever, but they're going to share a $200 million contract over the next few years. So that's not bad. That's not too bad.
Well, I'll tell you why I care about success. And I really want it. I crave it. I claw after it. But for one reason, because the more successful you are, the more resources you have, whether it's attention or financial or whatever, to do good in the world.
Totally agree. That's taken me a long time to understand from my upbringing, because I had a single mom. I was in fighter category. I was always about fight, fight, fight. So I always had that, you know, money's not important. And I still, you know, we were talking before we started recording, we were talking about the old voices, or, you know, you hear something, you feel something, it triggers you. My trigger is always like, oh, do I deserve that extra money? Do I deserve this? I have that, you know, that lack sense instead of that abundance. And that's one of the shifts I've been making, is that willingness to receive. Because here's the deal. Any currency transfer where we're sharing positive energy to build a better world has to have reception first. I have to have reception to energize to give of myself. And that's taken me, you know, I'm 49 years old and I've been teaching this stuff, but to be true to my audience and true to my listeners, it's taken me a long time to really fall in love with myself enough. And let's go back to your dad. Why was your dad so good at what he did? Because he had a lack of it. It wasn't his organic, natural ability to be somebody who really understood humans. My thing is, I literally am teaching the love and the fear model, which is really centered and focused on self-love to energize myself so I can be in service to others. Much of that was really me teaching myself. And now I've got a beautiful model. Yeah, and your dad did the same thing. I mean, it seems like you organically gravitate to the same kind of people who we understand how to support and build people. And our ultimate goal is to take the energy that we have and spread that energy to crystallize the brilliance in those who are hearing our messages. Because I can't imagine something more exciting to me than to see a listener or audience member light up. You know, when you see them light up and something resonated and they're like, you changed my life. I'm like, no. You changed your life. You showed up because you knew you were supposed to be here. You had enough self-love to be here today, to resonate with this message, to recognize it. It's you. But thank you for allowing me to be that mirror in that moment, and go be awesome. And that's it. So tell us a little bit. I mean, I know you've written an amazing book, and I know some of what you shared so far has been in that book. Tell us more about your book and tell us the name of that book.
Okay. The book is How to Be Up in Down Times.
Okay.
And you can find it on Amazon. Look for Mitzi Purdue. Or if you happen to be a fan of the Chicken Soup for the Soul books, yes, Mark Victor Hansen, he's the co-author. If you look up under Mark Victor Hansen or Mitzi Purdue, or if you just go to How to Be Up, you'll get it. And the history of that book is, long about early February, I have friends in China, and I was hearing a lot that made me think the pandemic is really going to be big, and there ought to be something we could do to help people.
Yeah.
And my background is, I've mentioned that I'm a writer. For probably 40 years altogether, I've written a syndicated column for Scripps Howard, not for the whole 40 years, but at least for a good chunk of it. And I'm a science writer for them. I'd write about the environment, but that meant interviewing scientists. I also wrote the blog for the Academy of Women's Health. I wrote for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News. But why I'm saying all this is, it means that I've got 40 years of talking with extraordinary experts, the best in their field, about all sorts of health, attitude. I have a lot of knowledge accumulated between, you know, for 40 years of one or two or three times a week interviewing world experts on issues that count. I suggested to Mark Victor Hansen, with his knowledge as probably one of the greatest inspirational people living, with his knowledge of inspiring people, and with my background as a science writer, we had an awfully good chance of being able to write a book that would be helpful to people. I mean, because I don't think anybody should underestimate the absolute seriousness of how disruptive the pandemic has been. And I'll share with you, in my case, I have a 92-year-old sister who, she got COVID. She's fine now, but, you know, the stress of, you know, there were maybe 4 days when family members were making plans that we really never wanted to make. She beat it. She's okay. But between health problems or relationship problems or financial problems or just the world's being turned upside down problems, that people could use some advice on how to be up in down times. And I wrote about a third of the book, and I shared tips that I know. I'll give a real quick one. People have told me they find to be really helpful. And that is, a lot of people have told me that they just don't feel their brains are as sharp as normal. You know, like you can't remember a name that you really should, or a figure that you should. Or I remember I was in a conference call recently, and there's a woman who's a CPA. We're both on the board of directors of an organization. And she couldn't do a simple math problem of dividing 50 into a million. And she said, I don't know what's wrong with me. I think Alzheimer's has begun. Well, the fact is, if you're under stress, your higher brain functions tend to get kind of rheostatted down, and your brain is flooded with stress hormones, cortisol, adrenaline, and you're all set to like run away from a lion. But if you have stress that's continuous, it does kind of lower your higher brain functions. I mean, when you're under stress, it's hard to balance your checkbook, for example. Well, the very good news is, well, there are two parts to my good news. The first is, it's almost certainly not Alzheimer's. If you're having pandemic brain, it's very likely just plain stress. What do you do about it? The more you can take or give yourself, and out of self-love, do this, respite. Something where you can just lose yourself and not be awash in all those stress hormones. And different people have different ways. But do things that help you escape. I mean, I'm all for, in this situation, for escapism. I call it respite. But maybe there's a movie you love that just you lose yourself in it. Or maybe there are YouTube videos. I particularly like animal pictures of like elephants rescuing each other. Or I know somebody else, for her, it gets her in a contemplative mood to sew. But whatever it is for you, give yourself, if you possibly can, an hour where you just turn off all the horrible things that are happening. And I don't want to minimize the horrible things because they're there and they're real. But give your brain respite so that it can have time to recover at least a little bit from pandemic brain, and do it every single day.
I love that.
Okay, that's the kind of advice that we give on how to be up. Another piece of advice that I cherish, how to be up, you know, of course, it's largely about happiness. And I think what I'm about to share with you and with our listeners is something that I think I can predict that you're going to love. On the subject of happiness, it's a story of Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of France, who, back in the 1800s, he had all the world's goodies to a greater extent than had ever happened before and probably since. You know, he controlled a good bit of Europe. He had all the money that anybody could imagine. He had all the status, all the glory, all the women, and he totally took advantage of it. I mean, he, one would think, had it all. In profound contrast was Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa had a vow of poverty and a vow of humility. So the physical objects that this woman owned during her lifetime were 3 cotton saris, you know, that cotton cloth that you wear. And the sandals on her feet. Those were only physical possessions. And with the vow of humility, she didn't allow herself to think, oh, I'm famous, I'm wonderful. Nope. She was focused on, as she put it, being a pencil in the hand of God, that she was there to serve. Who was happier? The man who had possibly the greatest accumulation of wealth and power and fame and status and sex of anybody ever? Well, we don't have to guess, because he wrote in his diary when he was in exile on the island of Elba. This is at the end of his days. He wrote, I cannot count 5 happy days. Now, so did all that stuff make him happy? Nope. What about Mother Teresa? He owns only 3 saris and a pair of sandals, but whose life is a life of love and service. She said, "My life is a feast of unending joy." So the lesson from that resonates with something that my mother used to say. The people who are takers, and Napoleon certainly was a taker, I mean, everything he had, he took from others, are miserable. The givers of the world are happy. So let's be givers.
I love that.
I want to add to it something that Frank said, which I also thought was all the wisdom in the world. If you want to be happy, think what you can do for somebody else. If you want to be miserable, think what's owed to you.
One of the things that I beat upon all the time, I tell everybody that happiness lies in one simple thing, the way you define self. And it's that simple. So if self to me is Scott, then everything outside of me, okay, is I'm grasping at everything else. I'm grasping at what can I take? If it's just my family, now this new tribe, there's going to be constant competition with everything else that I do because my tribe is just my family. What if the tribe is my extended family? What if my tribe is the city of Austin? What if my tribe is Texas? What if it's the United States? What if it's, you know, North America and Central and South America? I mean, we can go on and on. Here's my thing. The bigger you extend self, the happier you are, because when you extend self, you're always in service to what we call others, but now becomes self. So when I'm in service to you, does it make sense? So,
actually, how about an enlightening moment? Because I feel as if I've kind of sensed that, but never articulated it and couldn't pin it down and copy it and deal with it. But I know it's true.
Yeah. So think of this right now. If I'm saying, okay, I want to meet Mitzi because what can I get from Mitzi? Or I want to meet the guy down the street. What can I get from the guy down the street? Versus, well, of course I'm naturally connected to Mitzi because you're a human being. You're part of this universe. What can I do in service to you or together to help serve others? Let's pretend you went to get a massage and self is only your fingernail. So all you do is massage your fingernail. Well, that doesn't make sense. Imagine like you massage the entire body. Now it's the whole self. That's what we are doing. We're not just picking and choosing me or one part, because then the whole is never healed. And so that's the thing. Like right now with like, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's a certain, you know, group that, you know, is feeling oppressed or whatever, the minute we go after that injured component of self and heal it, everything else heals. And so I'm in a space right now where I just really want to look at where needs the healing the quickest. I have a very simple way that I look at existence. And for me right now is the reason I'm going to say in the sense of what this perspective point of Scott right now is bringing in service to the world. I am awakening those who feel hopeless because of the experiences they've went through. It's my whole goal. So that person can be rich, poor, it doesn't matter. They can be in another country. When I come across those people because they feel hopeless, you know, you recognized it with your dad where people are feeling unsafe. There's a hopelessness there. He elevated them to start that process. That's exactly what I'm doing. So if it's Black Lives Matter, if it's a group of people in the South who think they're losing their heritage or whatever, at the end of the day, I might not agree with a political stance or a viewpoint, but I want them to step up and start to rise in that hierarchy of self-actualization and self-fulfillment by extending self. And that's where I think our healing comes from. The quicker we get to that space where we can just fall in love with all of self and realize that all of us are just living our life according to our experience and find a way to help all of us heal. And that's not an easy thing, but I think we're on that track. And I'm always excited to meet more people like you to figure out ways that we can do that more efficiently and effectively.
I'd say that's almost my life purpose. I define it a little bit differently, but I think we come down to the same place. I figure that my purpose is to increase happiness and decrease misery.
Love it.
And love it. I do think that selfishness does lead to misery. Back to what Frank used to say, if you want to be happy, think what you can do for somebody else. You've extended yourself. You want to be miserable, think about me.
Yeah, because you can find a lot of stuff wrong here, but the more I look outside, I'm like, ooh, I like what they're doing. Let's figure out a way to amplify that. Or that's a beautiful message. So I'm going to jump on board with you and share that. And suddenly the opportunity becomes endless instead of so limited. And we've created this limited version of ourselves by limiting it to only this small being of our personal self. The minute we extend it, I mean, think of why people often become better people when they have kids. Suddenly you're living through them. So yeah. why don't we extend that and just say, I just birthed the universe and all of these people are my children. Well, how would you treat them? You treat them completely different. And that's what I think we're missing here on Earth, is we're not following that full extension of self. We're stopping it at my kids. I ask a question of my students, and I know it's a business class and this might not make sense, but I do a lot of social experiments with my students. And I say, there's two boats. Without plain semantics, there's one boat right there and one boat there. This boat over here to the left has 20 kids in it. This boat over here to the right has one kid in it. They're both out far enough. You're the only person on the beach. This is the way it's going to work. Both are sinking. You can only save the children or child in one boat. Which boat do you save? And so they start asking, can I save both? And there's no way you can save both. You got to pick one. So everybody says that 20 kids, of course. And I'm like, okay, there's one caveat. The one with one kid is your kid. Now which boat do you save? Yep. I know. And so I can tell you, in 13 years of teaching, only one student has ever, with all honesty, said, I would save the boat with 20. And this is the craziest thing. He actually had a wife. They were very young. They had a daughter together. The wife passed on. The only thing he has left is this daughter. And he still said he would save for the 20. And when I looked into his eyes, he meant it. So we can ask ourselves this question. Very few of us are ever going to get to that space in this existence where we would save 20. Because think about it. If I'm truly saying what I believe, that the whole is the self, then I should be saving that 20 without a question. And I don't know that I could do it yet.
I'm certain that I'd pick my kids or my kid.
I'm
going to be forgiving on this because I think we're wired that way. It takes a lot of effort and growth and love to get beyond it.
And so to my point, we still are human beings in this existence. But when we start putting benchmarks like that, like what would it take me to get to there? And at least like you're dead. Like he goes to, was it Mr. Connor? You go to get the training. Like there's one step after another. So all I'm doing is challenging people. And this is what I do with students. I'm challenging you to extend your sense of self with a really, really hardcore example. So if we start to say, wow, so I see that 20 families would be hugely affected versus one. So when you start to think like that, whether it's in business, whether it's in life, you make decisions saying, wait, if I fire this person, who's affected? What if I train this person instead of fire him? What if I look at a different, you start to think a little differently. So all I'm doing is, I know we might not be there yet. We talked about that growth mindset, but just to have a direction that what if we could expand the sense of self more and more and more individually till there's a point where we're so in love with all of humanity and know that we're all one. And that's, like you said, that's elevating the happiness, because we're so in love with all of us. Maybe that, incidence doesn't even arise. Maybe there's more people on the beach because we're all, I don't know. But the point is, it's a really hard thing to answer. And one student ever has said that. So.
What a breathtaking story.
Yeah. And every time I do it, I'm like, is there going to be one student? And everyone's like, I don't even have kids, but there's no way. And that's most of them. They don't even know what it's like to be a parent yet, and they still wouldn't save the 20. So that's just human nature.
Well, as I said, I sure know which way I'd answer. I'm nowhere near being able to be that out. I think my own analysis of myself is, I think I'm really quite altruistic. In defense of myself, I'll give an example. I always go economy class, whether I'm traveling to China or Botswana or wherever. I can certainly afford to go first class. But if I go first class, let's say China, because I know I'm up to date on what, or at least within a year of up to date of what it costs. First class is 12,000, or at least was. Economy is 1,000. I'm thinking, if I don't spend the first class money, I've got $11,000 more I can give away, and I do.
I love it.
The apartment that I live in, I'm a Sheraton heiress, I'm a chicken heiress. The apartment that I live in, it's in an apartment complex. My neighbors are, one's a librarian. One is somebody who is hoping to get, I'm trying to think of the exact term for it, a pandemic brain. She's like probationary to be hired at the sheriff's office. So she doesn't have a real high-paying job. The librarian doesn't have a real high-paying job. Several people are retired teachers. I am not a millionaire's row. I could certainly afford to be. But by having an inexpensive, relatively apartment to what I could afford, that means that there's more that I can give away, and it makes me much happier that way.
Oh my God, I'm just listening to it. And it's funny because, you know, we live in a nice house, but it's not the most amazing neighborhood in Austin with great intention. We buy our cars used in cash. I have a 2007 Grand Cherokee. Could you have more? Sure. But what's wrong with my 2007 Grand Cherokee that I take care of? It's fine. So,
well, you beat me by 4 years because my Prius is 2011.
All right, there you go. So we're going to get you back to a 2007 because we're going to be, it still runs great. So you got to have a good mechanic who's a former student. That's how this works. So that's awesome. Well, cool. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, this has been an amazing opportunity to get to know you better. What can we leave our listeners with? What final piece of advice? Because, you know, you've shared so much amazing stuff with talking about, you know, how your dad and Frank have really lived, and there's been so many amazing tidbits. The book, the story about Napoleon, you know, versus Mother Teresa and happiness, all amazing for us to ponder and think more deeply about. What can we give them if there's one thing? And let's assume that this is going to be heard not only during this time of the pandemic, but in the future. What can we give them one thing if there's a piece of advice that everybody needs that maybe they're not receiving from the world right now?
All right, I'm going to give you some advice that is unexpected and deeply held. I think it's going to shock you.
Okay.
I wish that each tell their friends to listen to this, because I think this is one of the more important forces in the world.
That's actually a really good idea, because what you're really doing is encouraging the spread of some good information, because there's so much in this one podcast that
I meant to all your podcasts, because what you stand for, I think, is one of the most positive forces. I mean, as somebody who loves, I mean, I'm not at the stage of that I care about 20 people's children more than my own, but I do care about people. And it does seem to me that happiness is increased when love is spread.
I agree.
And since my purpose in life is to increase happiness and decrease misery, I would love our listeners. I don't care that much about my being a guest, although of course I love and cherish it. No, I want them to have people sign up to keep listening.
Well, thank you so much. And I absolutely loved having you on the show, and I love you to death. And I can't wait to see what we can do in the future. We'll make sure that Go Love Now expands, that your book is sold. And tell them, Mom, where they can find your book.
Okay, it's How to Be Up in Down Times. Mm-hmm. It's available on Amazon. If you'd like to get hold of me, and I promise to answer all emails, go to MitziPurdue.com. There's a contact form, and if you take the trouble to write to me, I'll sure take the time to answer you.
Oh, that's absolutely beautiful. And we connected that way too. So we should thank our good friend, JV Crum, who connected us, who's a wonderful guy. And he had beautiful things to say about you. And you know the way he matches people up. He goes, I have somebody you have to meet. And of course, he's listening to both of us, obviously going, these are two people, two peas in the same pod. So it was nice that he was kind enough to do that.
Okay, then a special message to JV. You done good.
That's awesome. And I love what he's representing right now, where he's doing a lot of his soul searching too, and his deep work. So he's on board with all the stuff we're doing. And it's beautiful to, you know, have him as a part of this show too, and now have you. So once again, I thank you for being on. I love you to death. And thanks again, Mitzi. I appreciate you.
I have loved this. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This episode of The Awakening You is brought to you by the Speaking to the Heart Podcast Network. If you'd like to experience our interactive show notes for this episode, we invite you to visit us at speakingtotheheart.org.
With McDelivery, get your favorites like a juicy quarter pounder, golden fries, and crispy chicken McNuggets. Ordering is easy. Choosing which you'll eat first, not as easy.
Every day at McDonald's, share a classic Big Mac pack with two Big Mac sandwiches, two medium fries, and a 20-piece chicken McNuggets. Get it with McDelivery or mobile order and pay. Price and participation may vary. Delivery prices may be higher than at restaurants. Delivery fee, service fee, and or small order fee may apply.
Get it contactless with McDelivery.
Where you live shouldn't limit your access to quality internet. That's not fair.
U.S. Cellular introduces fast and fair high-speed internet. With reliable home internet from U.S. Cellular, now there's no limit to how you stream, game, and work. So instead of this, you get this. Upgrade to fast and fair high-speed internet from U.S. Cellular. Upgrade to fair.